From Wondery, I'm Stephen Johnson, and this is Fighting Coronavirus. Since the beginning of this podcast, we've been asking you, our listeners, to write in with suggestions for topics for us to cover on this show. A good number of you wrote in with questions and concerns about what lasting effects this pandemic might have on our education system, and really, on our kids' development. This is something I've been thinking about a lot myself as the parent of three teenagers. It's everything from profound questions like, how do I talk to my kids about a mass tragedy like the COVID-19 pandemic? All the way to the more prosaic questions, like, is it healthy for a growing brain to play Minecraft or Call of Duty for 9 straight hours? So whether you have kids in preschool or teenagers about to head off to college, it's difficult to predict how this disruption might impact their trajectories. To dig into some of the challenges educators are facing today, and what they're anticipating for tomorrow, we have Anya Kamenetz on the show this week. She's an education correspondent for NPR and the author of several books about education and parenting. Her most recent book, The Art of Screen Time, is a don't panic guide for parents looking to balance their children's use of devices.
Have you and your family had enough of your phone screens for one day? How about a board game? You check the hall closet? Maybe there's an old Monopoly. Nothing? Well, don't worry. Kidding Around Toys has got you covered. As a family-run toy store for over 30 years, they know exactly how to keep you and your family occupied at a time like this. They offer a wide selection of unique toys, games, and activities for all ages. Need a recommendation? Owner Christina and her staff of two daughters will gladly help you during these unique and family-centric times. For a quarantine discount with free shipping to all U.S. customers, head over to kiddingaroundtoys.com/discount/Wondery. Have a little fun while you're at home with family.
Anya Kamenetz, thank you so much for joining us on Fighting Coronavirus.
Thanks so much for having me.
We like to start off every episode with just a little kind of personal check-in to see how you're doing. Everybody's inventing a whole new life for themselves in this crisis. What's going on with you right now?
Yeah, so I am in a townhouse in Greenpoint with two little girls and a husband who has an office in the basement, which is great for him. And we also have a neighbor helping us out with childcare. She's our tenant, so she's part of the household as well. And that means that there is Montessori going on. There's third grade going on. My husband's actually company is a hardware company, so there's hardware being built. And then I'm upstairs sometimes broadcasting and sometimes podcasting and sometimes cutting tape and interviewing people from literally all over the world.
You're in Brooklyn. To the extent that you can sense it locked in your house, like, what's the feeling there in at the kind of epicenter of the outbreak right now?
It's really eerie, Stephen. And because we're so caught off from each other, it really is a short circuiting of the inherent nature of this place, which is its density, right? So the reason that we love New York is because everything is close together and everybody is close together. And that's exactly what we can't have right now. At the same time, you know, I've never spent such a long time without leaving my neighborhood and being in walking distance for everything. I don't get into cars or get on the subway. So I know my street so intimately now, and my neighbors, we really feel like a family almost, the people on our block, because we're sharing information, we're connecting on WhatsApp, and then everybody comes out on their stoop and applauds for the essential workers at 7 o'clock. And that's such an incredible ritual that is really bringing us through this spring.
Let's dive in to the main reason we wanted you to come on the show, which is really to look at the question of education. Just big picture right now, according to UNESCO, there are 188 countries around the world that have closed schools nationwide. which is like apparently affecting like 1.5 billion learners.
Right.
What are the most pressing like challenges right now facing the education system?
The challenges facing the education system really kind of show us all the different functions that education plays in society, right? So I think the first thing that was on a lot of school leaders' minds when they thought about closing schools was feeding children, because our school lunch program is the second biggest anti-hunger program in the country, in the United States. And it's similar in lots of middle and higher income countries. It's very, very important. So getting food to kids. Secondly, you know, we're thinking about dangers that children are exposed to when they are out of the watchful eyes of the school system. So very vulnerable children, you know, here in New York City, 1 in 10 kids are homeless. So that's a major concern. And then we're thinking about the social and emotional impact. So a lot of people have told me that being out of school for months on end during a giant crisis really qualifies as like an adverse childhood experience. And so there's a lot of research showing that adverse childhood experiences, whether that be like a parent's incarceration or drug addiction, they have toxic effects on brain development, and they have toxic effects even on chronic illness. So things that you can see that shorten people's lives. So it's very major. And you notice I haven't even mentioned learning, right?
right.
That's a major concern as well. But it just goes to show you all of the really important roles that school plays in children's lives.
We've been asking our listeners to email us with questions for upcoming shows, and we've had a lot of questions about education and all this, and the anxiety question about kids, both as parents and as educators. How do you get the kids to manage their anxiety in a situation like this? I mean, what lessons have you seen? What have you heard from educators on that front?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I think if there's any silver lining to this happening now, it's that we have a much more robust conversation and background knowledge about childhood anxiety, because it has become more common and it's much more talked about. So the basics that people say are children do need information, because they're going to construct narratives out of limited information that they get. And so the better you can give them a handle on what's going on to an age-appropriate extent, I think that's the better it's going to be. Also, having kind of a toolbox around what do I do when I'm feeling spiraling out, or I'm feeling physical symptoms of anxiety. So teaching kids about deep breathing, or maybe something like having a soft blanket or something you can hold on to. So making sure that those are rituals that are really affirmed in the family, I think, are really helpful. And then something really interesting that we know about anxiety is that it doesn't get better when you avoid the triggers. So if you try to construct a child's world where they never have to confront something that they're afraid of, that doesn't give that sense of accomplishment and overcoming the anxiety. In this context, I think it's really interesting, because what that might mean is if your child's afraid of going outside, for example, or they're afraid of touching something, that you don't follow that anxiety, but you try to say, okay, within these limits that we've set that are to keep everyone safe, we should continue to, you know, go outdoors and enjoy things, because that could have a really long-lasting effect. I mean, I see now my three-year-old, you know, I'm taking her out to the park and she's getting the message that she should avoid other children. And that breaks my heart, because that goes against every instinct of a, you know, a little girl who's so outgoing. So figuring out how to manage that and not make that anxiety be inappropriate or take it beyond the time when she needs it, I think is something that's really on my mind.
One thing I've been thinking about with older kids, I have teenagers. I just like to use this opportunity to complain about them for a while on the show. No, with older kids, when you think about anxiety, the opportunity here is to combat that anxiety with a sense of agency, a sense that you can do something to reduce the threat that you're anxious about. And that thing that you're doing is staying at home, creating the sense of like, hey, there is solidarity here. Even though we're all in our own apartments or homes, we are all collectively working to combat this threat. And having, as a 15-year-old or 16-year-old, a kind of almost civic experience that is weirdly private and isolated, but nonetheless is about collective action. That's a wonderful lesson, I think, for a 15-year-old to learn, and also a way of combating the sense of helplessness, I think, that sometimes you get in situations like this, that you can't do anything with the threat. In fact, we can, and we're all doing it, and we're seeing results from it.
I think that's a really good observation. And, you know, I've been talking to a lot of high school students in my reporting, and this is especially hard on them, right? Because they are oriented towards their peers, and that's who they care about. And because they are in these transition moments where all of a sudden everything's been thrown into uncertainty, whether your child cares about sports or they care about theater or they care about doing well in the SATs or getting into a good college, none of those things are possible right now. They're all up in the air. And so history shows us that the teenagers really are the ones who suffer the most from a major disruption like this. And figuring out ways for them to be participatory and to, like you said, I mean, engage civically even from their bedrooms, I think is a really, really crucial antidote to what we might see happen, which a lot of teenagers now are, they're really drifting away from these touch points that that we had made important milestones in their lives.
It is true. I never really occurred to me, but there is that period, kind of end of high school and through college, where there are these rites of passage that you only get one pass at.
Yeah.
Right. You only graduate once, you only get one senior prom, you know. And so, you know, my oldest son, who's not going to have an official graduation ceremony, he's not going to have a real, you know, senior prom. There's no going back in time and recreating those. There's something really kind of tragic about that.
I'm very cautious about, you know, making silver linings out of this emergency. But one development that I find rather interesting is that one of the first things that we dropped in this crisis was standardized testing and the notion of creating kind of national benchmarks for children, because it just wasn't going to make any sense to do that in this context. And I wrote a book about standardized testing and kind of how horribly limiting and arbitrary it is as a system for grading and ranking people and comparing them. And the idea that there's a year that goes by where no kid gets labeled or sorted in this totally arbitrary way, there's some freedom in that. Nobody chose it, and very few people would have wanted it. But this is a class that graduates and everything has an asterisk. And I would hope that for some who, you know, get the opportunity to face this with resilience, that there's something amazing about that, because they have to decide for themselves what they want to learn and how they want to learn it and what's really important to them, because this is a time when really everything's up for grabs.
Do you think that there's a possibility that if there is a significant interruption to standardized testing over the next year, that will also, in a sense, accelerate some of the movement away from standardized testing long term?
The thing that's happening is that high stakes standardized testing doesn't make sense, because we can see that the testing isn't measuring anything that important with regard to student performance. However, immediately people are saying, but we definitely need diagnostic tests. We need tests that simply evaluate students without punishing them for that, you know, what the evaluation says. And so a shift in the purpose of testing, I think, could go a long way as far as a lot of the negative effects that are created by standardized testing happen when you attach high stakes to the tests. So, you know, I believe that when the kids come back into regular schooling, they're going to all need to be evaluated, because they'll be in very different places. And that's going to be the first step to serving them equitably. But that's very different from saying, oh, this is a failing school or this is a failing kid because of what the score says.
I want to turn a little bit to kind of virtual learning and screens, and start with the question of equality in all of this. And we got an email from a listener named Marcy, who's a chemistry professor at a university. And she was talking about the number of students she's got. She's in the middle of the country. She's got a bunch of students who don't have reliable high-speed internet at home. And you just had a recent article on the NPR site citing a stat that somewhere around 12 million students have no broadband internet at home. Mm-hmm. What are you seeing on the ground in terms of educators and schools dealing with that kind of inequality issue?
I think the fear here is that this transition to emergency stopgap virtual learning really explodes all kinds of gaps, because we know from the research that online learning is amazing for a very small proportion of highly motivated, highly skilled learners. They really can zoom ahead when they work on their own pace and their own interests. And then for people that work at a disadvantage, online learning is is a force multiplier of disadvantage. So even forget, you know, pretend that you got them a Chromebook and you got them a hotspot and they're able to sign on and they're, you know, their parents are not essential workers and they have 2 hours a day and they don't have another sibling. Pretend all of that is in place for the poorest children or the children that were just a little bit behind grade level. They're not going to do as well because they don't have the teacher there. And I spoke to Jose Vilson, who's a teacher in Harlem, and he said, this is no longer compulsory schooling because all of the tools that I had in my toolbox to organize, manage, motivate, sometimes punish my students to get them on the ball, I don't have any of them anymore. And so it's really huge. And I think it gets to the point where some people who think about equity wonder if the effort is best spent creating these online learning plans and maintaining them, which is a lot of effort for the teachers, or whether we should be focusing instead on lower bandwidth, literally solutions, or on remediation and making up for the time sometime when we get back. So that's a genuine debate, I think.
That's very interesting. What's your general sense of preparedness out there in schools? What percentage had some kind of long-term remote learning plan on the books already? And what percentage are just inventing this like on the fly for the first time?
I don't think any public school district in the country had a comprehensive remote learning plan in place that was long-term. So depending on the region, in some places they have snow days and they've done remote learning on a snow day. In some places they have hurricane plans. Houston, after Hurricane Harvey, kind of made contingency plans for if they had to close for some part of the semester. So those things were there. And then the other part of it is laptop programs and Google Classroom and other systems were in place in a certain extent. So most districts were not starting completely from scratch. But I think that we see both in higher ed and in K-12 that there's a very big difference between taking a class and putting it online in the matter of a few days versus creating an online course, which is a very complicated process that involves, you know, instructional technology specialists and takes a lot of time to do well. So everybody's kind of improvising. Everybody's making things up as they go along. They had a few pieces in place in different places. Florida, interestingly, is one that I looked at that really felt like they were in good shape, not only because of equipment, but because Florida happens to have a publicly affiliated online virtual K-12 school that already operates in the state with like over 200,000 students. So they were kind of able to seed the development of online learning a little more easily in that state.
Are there any other examples that you've seen in your reporting of folks doing really inventive new experiments that the rest of us can learn from?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple different ones. So the one that I'm working on right now is a story about WhatsApp. So there's a small kind of social enterprise startup that created WhatsApp courses that have, you know, a pretty small interactive element with quizzes and short answers. It's just super, super low bandwidth. And they have deployed it in Uganda in a refugee settlement to spread basic information about COVID-19 because the alternative to that is literally driving around in a car with information blaring over the speakers in the car. So this is appropriate technology, right? This is something that they can get to people. And then that same WhatsApp company, which is called Arist, is also being used by a community organization in Alabama to also reach teenagers with basic information that they need. It's not virtual reality. It's not anything that's new technology. It's just a new application that's appropriate for the context.
Right now, I'm so grateful for our sponsor, The Great Courses Plus. If you haven't heard of them, they're this incredible streaming service with an extensive library of topics where you can watch or listen to courses on meditation and yoga, pick up a new hobby like painting, cooking, gardening, even learn guitar or speak a new language. I love The Great Courses because it reminds me of one of my favorite periods of my life, going to college and listening to an incredibly inspiring lecture. One course I think you'll enjoy is called The Science of Mindfulness, A Research Path to Well-Being. In this course, a Harvard psychologist shares ancient mindfulness techniques, which neurobiologists have proven to affect our brains. With the Great Courses Plus app, you can watch or listen at any time from a phone, tablet, or internet-connected TV. So if you're ready to get started, the Great Courses Plus is giving listeners of our show this great offer, a free month-long trial of unlimited access to the entire library. Sign up today using our special URL and start your free month trial at thegreatcoursesplus.com/fightingcv. That's fighting CV as in coronavirus. Remember, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/fightingcv. If you're stuck at home these days, you probably don't think much about internet privacy on your home network. Fire up incognito mode on your browser and no one can see what you're doing, right? Wrong. Even in incognito mode, your online activity can still be traced. That's why, even when I'm at home, I never go online without using ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN makes sure your ISP can't see what sites you visit. Instead, your internet connection is rerouted through ExpressVPN's secure servers, which means everything you do is anonymized and can't be traced back to you. They also encrypt 100% of your data with the best in-class encryption, so your information is always protected. Use the internet with confidence from your computer, tablet, or smartphone. ExpressVPN has you covered on every device. Simply tap one button and you're protected. Protect your online activity today with the VPN that I trust to secure my privacy. Visit expressvpn.com/innovations. And you can get an extra 3 months free on a one-year package. That's expressvpn.com/innovations. One more time, expressvpn.com/innovations to learn more.
If you're looking for a bit of escapism, try getting lost in the Richlands family drama. The story starts with Eleanor and Michael Richland having just lost their parents in a plane crash. As they reckon with this tragedy, something about their father's legacy just isn't adding up. The siblings come face to face with two choices: protect the family empire or risk losing everything to find the truth. You can subscribe to Blood Ties on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now.
I'm going to turn to the screen time question. This is something you and I have both written about a lot. You wrote a terrific book called The Art of Screen Time, an important book for parents before this period, right? We were all wrestling with this question of what is the appropriate amount of screen time? What is the appropriate kind of screen time? So what was the general gist of that book? And then we can think about it in terms of the actual crisis now.
The hidden narrative of that book was about scientific literacy, because there was a growing body of extremely alarmist research about something called technology addiction and how it was going to destroy our youth. And that body of knowledge was really a part of a cultural tradition of moral panic, which you've also explored in your books, about the alarm that is raised when young people connect with new technology, because young people tend to be very excited about new technologies, and especially new communication technologies. So in teaching parents to kind of read through that literature and come to understand, okay, there are some things to be concerned about, but this isn't toxic radon gas, or this isn't an invisible virus, let's say, going into your home, I think it was promoting of a kind of informed, relaxed, balanced attitude towards the role of tech in kids' lives. And honestly, since the pandemic, I've gotten a lot of positive feedback about this general approach, because I think even the most tech-averse parents have suddenly discovered that their kids need to have screen time. They need to be connecting to school often. They need to be connecting to their family and to their friends. And the screen is the medium for all of those things. So keeping your kids off of it isn't really the key anymore. The key is understanding the good and the not-so-good uses of it, understanding what is really filling them up and making them happy and what might be contributing to, you know, bad habits or bad tendencies, and then not being hypocrites ourselves as parents and understanding that it's good for us also to not have devices in the bedroom at night and to not do two things at once when we're talking to our family members. So I think by families all being home together all the time, there's a lot of opportunity for us to create family-wide habits that we all stick to, rather than it being parents dictating to kids how they should act with their devices.
One of the things that I've thought about a lot, you know, my kids are, I have three boys and they're all, you know, video game players, right? And it's such a striking thing of how social the games are, because they're, you know, these kind of network games. And to me, when you watch them playing, you know, a game like Fortnite or something like that, there's so much going on, right? When you spend the time as a parent to actually figure out what they're doing in the game. One, there's just kind of hangout time and they're chatting with their friends and, you know, having a conversation while they're doing this complicated, immersive activity, collaborating with people, competing with other people in a very complex space with lots of complex problem-solving skills that have to, you know, be exploited to win the game or compete at the game. I think parents don't see that, and so they just assume that it's a complete colossal waste of time because they didn't kind of grow up with those kinds of social experiences.
That's exactly right. And I mean, one of the things I talk about in my book is that we have a cultural paradigm for the soccer mom, but we don't have the Minecraft mom.
Right.
And that's kind of what we need to have right now is just that supportive listening ear. You don't want to be completely ignoring what your kids are doing online. That's not beneficial, but you know, being supportively listening to what they're doing rather than always condemning it, I think is kind of a key thing.
One of the things that has come up about education, we had one listener write in that every year there are students matriculating to new schools. There's rising high school and college freshmen. What happens to those first years if the schools haven't reopened? You know, is there going to be this kind of lost year potentially? And earlier, a couple of episodes ago, I talked to Richard Florida, the great urbanist, and this came up, and he was talking about maybe there's a lost year that actually becomes part of the ritual. Like there's everybody has a gap year going forward, and that becomes the opportunity for some kind of national civil service or something like that for a kind of rising college freshman, which was kind of a crazy idea, but there was something kind of lovely about it. what have you seen in terms of the concerns about next fall, basically?
So we have long-term research on this. There's a paper that I cited in one of my articles about the Rwanda genocide, and it found it takes years and years for educational attainment to bounce back after an interruption. You know, and I'm not necessarily comparing the pandemic to the genocide in its scale, but basically the idea is a lot of kids kind of get knocked off course, and the degree to which they get knocked off course really depends on a lot of different factors of how this takes place. Now, the question of whether we somehow change the treadmill, you know, and this kind of chute that we've created for kids that goes from competitive high school admissions to competitive college admissions to competitive job market is an interesting one. And I think we have to look at who is that really working for already and who is it not working for? So to the degree that we have a very large number of students in this country who are actually working adults and parents and who are taking already 4, 5, 6, 7 years to finish their degrees because they're working and they're starting at community colleges. And so the path that we have in our heads perhaps for this small percentage of high-achieving kids, it exists as a model and it's reinforced by the culture. It's never been available to that many people. If we can destigmatize the idea of taking a wander and taking a gap year or doing community service and say that's a normal thing to do, that's a celebrated thing to do, I think it could be helpful for everyone.
That's a perfect segue to the last big question I wanted to ask you, which I kind of alluded to before. I mean, the thing I keep thinking about on multiple fronts with this crisis is how much of this is going to turn out to be really short-term reactions followed by a return to the old ways. And how much is actually going to end up leading to fundamental changes where we stumble across a new way of organizing things and we end up saying, hey, that's actually a better way to do it. I know this is super early in this process and it's a tough question to ask, but like, do you have a sense of what some of the long-term outputs of this might be in terms of education?
My gut feeling is that things will never be the same and that we're on a massive path of reorganization. And when I think about the kinds of changes that are needed, so some things that are necessary that are happening in education that are good are we've had a very large increase in access to formal education. There's also this burgeoning movement to have learners be the center of their education process and to be able to have choice and agency and learn about things that are relevant and combine hands-on learning with technologically connected learning. One thing that's happening in this crisis to a new extent is the collaboration of educators all over the world in thinking about how to do this because there are no longer, you know, meaningful physical barriers to collaboration because people are not only working on a local basis with their local students, but they're trying to look around for solutions and for approaches. So I think that when those kinds of networks form, in crises, they tend to stick and people continue to use that knowledge and those relationships to plan for the future. And so that's what I'm looking for, is where are the educators that are really taking a global view and collaborating and planning, and how are they going to continue to do that in the future to create a future of education that prepares people for this kind of unimaginably different world that we're entering into.
Well, Anya Kamenetz, thank you so much appropriately for a discussion about education. I know I've learned a lot, and I hope you'll come back in a future episode to do an update on what's happening on the school front as this crisis develops, and stay safe in Brooklyn.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Fighting Coronavirus from American Innovations. If you want to help share our series with others, please tell your friends to subscribe and give us a 5-star review. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app, or you can listen ad-free on Wondery Plus. Also, we want to hear from you. What topics do you want us to talk about? Do you have stories you want to share from your experience? You can email us questions, or even better, email us a voice memo with your question or story at fightingcorona@wondery.com. That's fightingcorona@wondery.com. If you like the show, please tell your friends to subscribe and give us a 5-star review. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app, or you can listen ad-free on Wondery Plus. This series is hosted and produced by me, Stephen Johnson. It's also produced by Natalie Shishon and Michelle Lanz. Sound designed by Jake Gorski. Executive producers are Jenny Lauer-Beckman, Marshall Louie, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.